So we used to do meetings once upon a time because we would have all this information that comes through the organization.
And
that led from having one administrative meeting a month to then having two meetings a month because we didn't have time to talk about submissions and editorial and acquisitions in the same meeting. So then we had a meeting every other week all the time. The staff was about the same size as it is now. So it was also very expensive to have that many meetings all the time. And it was nothing was coming of them. You know, it was just like people over time, when you have a meeting, they just like repeat back what has been said at the previous meeting, and there's no like critical thinking or learning or, you know, it's just resuscitating what people already know. And then this evolved because we felt like we had spun that into so many meetings that we were then like, oh, we should have check-ins with people when they need check-ins, and then have editorial, you know, and so now we're going to break it out to having two editorial meetings a year, and then things like this maybe once a month to focus in on a specific subject. This time we're going to talk about acquisitions, and we're going to take it apart, and we're going to put it back together. So we're going to go back to real nuts and bolts and back to basics, because that's often the thing that leads to dismantling a task back to why we do it and how to make it better. Acquisitions is how new titles are added to the catalog. Why do publishers acquire new books?
That's how they make money.
That is the relatively skeptical view of the matter.
To build their identity as a brand.
Ooh, that is very good. Yes, yes.
And customers always want to see something new.
It is like if you don't acquire new titles all the time, people forget about you. You know, and that was a real bad trend of, like, 2007, where, like, publishers would ease towards bankruptcy, and their solution would be to stop publishing new books, which just, like, causes them to, like, shrivel up further. If you don't publish new books, people just forget about you. And, like, from a sales perspective, yeah, there's no reason to, like, approach a customer if you don't have something new. Like, you can go back endlessly and be like, do you need more of this thing that you've bought before? And they might not that week. It seems like the magic number is, like, if you have six things they want, they'll always need something from you. You know, three other pragmatic things are you want the title in question to fit easily into your existing core competencies, so it's seamless. You don't want to have to, like, invent new wheels. You don't want to have to do extensive research or learning about a new subject. You don't want to have to, like, get enmeshed in new communities. That's, like, very time-consuming and expensive and confusing, and, you know, like, that's kind of why publishers get bad reputations, is because they, like, aren't actually involved in these things, but they're trying to market to these things, you know? So you really want to be like, why are we publishing this book? Like, why? How does this fit into what we already do well? Second reason is it allows better access to stores and audiences that the publisher is interested in interacting with. So if, like, you wanted to do more outdoor books, you would get, like, some walking guides and things like that, you know? If you wanted to get into more witchcraft stores, you'd have more of those books. If you wanted to get into record stores, you have more music books, you know? If you want to get into Urban Outfitters, you have photography books, apparently. Like, if you have one really good book, you're probably not going to have a good reason to talk to somebody. You know, you need enough of a critical mass of force. So the more you have in a single category, the more appealing it is, you know? Further, that clarifies the publisher's interest, which is pretty vital, you know? You want people to know what you're all about. Otherwise, why would they know to talk to you? The number one misconception is that publishers are, like, arbiters of taste, which is just, like, a dumb misnomer from, like, MFA programs or something, you know? People think that, like, if a book is good enough, that any publisher would be thrilled to have it, which is, like, kind of the opposite, you know? It's more about, like, does it fit into the catalog, you know? Does it fit into core competency? So, and then the third pragmatic reason is, while a title may not have tremendous potential or sales, it is something that will sell steadily and reliably for years. You know, it's like what you call an evergreen. It may never have a big windfall, but, like, it's much better to have, you know, like, we sell 40 copies of this every month, rain or shine, this being Hot Pants, you know. Do-it-yourself gynecology and herbal remedies. It was also just kind of the closest book at hand. Originally published in 1993, these things don't tremendously change, you know. So, you know, like, we never had a big hit with that book, but it's more like, it's never going to go out of style. So why is the book a bad fit?
Not good, intelligently done, you know, writing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, are lots of bad information. But yeah. Also, the lack of good graphics and a really appealing cover.
Very, like, lack of credibility and just, like, incoherent design, like, yeah. Bad. Yeah,
poor
I'm just
development.
Not. Yeah, poor development. That's
like,
you really
could have the best idea, but if it's poorly developed, mm-hmm. then it's actually not the best idea.
Right.
Even though it could be a really good, important idea.
Because no one knows what it is.
Mm-hmm.
Or why they care.
Mm-hmm.
Or if it's for them. One, like, the biggest problem you can have is there's no audience for your book. Meaning, like, it's too introspective or inaccessible. Like, it doesn't do anything for anybody but the author. Or, like Jerry and Sydney said, the development is unclear. Or, you know, it's like, there's totally, like, artistic, therapeutic value to writing a book. But there's no reason to, like, involve a publisher in the machinations of that book. You know, like, it's not... You don't have to, like, go to market when you, like, make something for yourself. And I think people forget that. But, so, number two, a book is good... But outside of the publisher's core competencies, like, you've brought it to the wrong place, you know, that kind of thing. So some examples are, like, a fictional publisher, or a fiction publisher wouldn't publish a travel guide, you know, because they don't have the relationships for that. Or, like, a romance publisher wouldn't publish, like, a book of inspirational quotes about dogs, because, like, again, people would be very confused when they picked it up alongside their other books, and they're like, why is this anomaly here? You know, the reason we make these brochures that are thematic is, like, you know, mental health. It's not, like, an accident that we published a bunch of mental health books. It was by design, you know, because they go well together. And same thing with, like, the witchcraft catalog. It's thematic books that were not just, like, lackadaisically picked up. It was like, oh, okay, if we have all these books, then we can, like, have a reason to talk to these accounts. And the same thing with the zines, and we have one for record stores, and we have one for comic shops. And, you know, things like that, it's like, if you build it that way, you know, then it, like, makes sense to your audience, which is almost the most important thing. It's like, they have to have a good handle on who you are and what you're about. Even if there's a market for your book, you still need to go to the publisher that is in a position to reach your audience. So, third... The work to research and reach the book's audience can be just too expensive and difficult. Like, we don't have the ability to reach all audiences all the time. And that takes away from core competencies and things that are otherwise successful, so that's difficult. You know, so similarly, a publisher attempting to self-finance extensive growth too quickly fails far more often than it succeeds, which really helps no one, you know? So you have to be sort of methodical in sequence, you know, and unless you're have a lot of financing and are going really fast. The market is far too crowded for the book, you know. So, for example, there's hundreds of books about kombucha in print right now. You can buy a book about kombucha at every price from 99 cents to $39.95, and you could probably find like a $150 technical book on kombucha if you really tried. So why is this book about kombucha worth existing? What is different about it? Why wouldn't someone interested in this subject just buy, like, a more familiar name? Does anybody know what a brand is?
It's what you do to keep your cattle from getting stolen.
Incorrect. Actually, correct, but not what we're looking for.
Also, the weight and recognition of your name.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's like what people associate with you when they think of you.
The impression.
You're striding out in a new direction. You have to be definitive and do it more than once. You know, you have to have a plan in place. You know, so, like, as we move into, like, queer erotica, we couldn't just publish one because it would fail. We'd have to have a few on deck, you know. So that is shifting. Like, this was my, I think it was 2013 when I wrote a blog post on your former blog for Ellie Blue Publishing, where I said that branding would matter for publishers more and more, small publishers, and that has happened. Jostradamus was correct. And this has been the real, like, revelation in of the year, is that the series matter now for publishers. Like, a series from even a really small publisher matters more than the author's brand, because the author used to be the brand that people bought around. And now you'll see it all the time, where, like, a publisher will have a series that'll have every book by a different author, and they will all sell because people are stocking the whole series. Or similarly, like, if you look at, like, a Penguin book, they always have the penguin on the cover. You know, like, that's them trying to lean on their brand if it's, like, a book that you don't know about, or if it's, like, Morrissey's autobiography or something like that, you know? So they want to say, like, okay, we're credible because, like, this is our book, we worked on it, you know? So the crowded market problem is 1,000 times worse in fiction, because you have to establish a very clear niche, such as, like, pregnant men, erotica, or feminist bicycle science fiction. And there's people that read every single book in those, because that's their thing, you know, and there's not enough of them, you know, so, like, it's a good thing to get into for now, until it's overrun, you know. But when you do general fiction, it kind of kills it, because there's so much, and then you're competing with all the big names, and, like, you're suffering the brand problem again. So if you're going that route, you have to steady your horse for, like, a really expensive, long, bumpy ride of establishing reputation as consistent and credible in that category. Otherwise, there's no way to do it. So, more importantly, Microcosm needs every book to have a strong value proposition with clear and practical emotional payoff for the reader, not just for the author. You know, like, the author knows why they wrote the book. But Please Don't Feed the Bears was published, I think we did the originals way long time ago, like 2002, and then we first published this book in 2006 when somebody came into our store and suggested that we get in touch with the author again, because he was having a hard time and might enjoy putting a more proper book together. So we did, and then this did, you know, this has gone through 3 printings, so that's, you know, and they're 5,000 a piece, so it's substantial. Like, we've done a lot, and it's a pretty unorthodox book, but, you know, that was us approaching the author and, you know, having some success with that, which can be a pretty good way if you're kind of on the same page. And Make Your Place was sort of the opposite, where the author had made a series of zines that we published, and then we suggested that they make a proper book, and they said no one would be interested in that, and then we pushed again because they have this nice aesthetic, and then she said that there was a lot of books already and she didn't really want to do it, and then through some prodding she acquiesced, and then we've sold now 150,000 of these things. So that is kind of a wild thing to have to talk somebody into. So this book, The Practical Witch's Almanac, Jerry pitched the author to purchase from us for her store, and then she came back and said, I've been self-publishing this almanac for all these years. And we did it as a drop-in, meaning there wasn't, like, advance notice to the industry. We printed within a month, and we immediately sold out of the printing. So we doubled our printing the following year, and we're now into the third printing of that doubled printing. So we should have started with 7,000 is what I'm learning from this. So
I had 3 calls already this week for that, for 2020, asking when it's arriving.
Whoa.
Yeah.
And we have the 2021 on deck, so you learn a little bit each time. Wild Fermentation, the author, before he had any credibility, he sent us a letter in 2001 sheepishly asking us to publish this, and we did, and it was sort of a sleeper, you know, evergreen but slow, until 2010, when we found that we were selling tens of thousands of these, and we tried to figure out why, because nobody tells you when your author gets famous is kind of the weird part. You know, we did a new edition because we were like, okay, people clearly want this thing. And then we made the fancier version that's, you know, because the problem is this is $6.95, so it's not, you know, it's not the best way to make use of the content. And, you know, he's done a number of books since this, so it's a little harder to, you know, he's not going to come back to doing a new book, but, you know, keeping this selling perpetually is a really healthy thing for everybody. And then similarly, the author of Walking with Ramona came up to us at the PNBA show in, I think it was in Tacoma that year, and which is the regional bookseller's show, and she had done books with Timber Press. And she said, oh, I have this Walking with Ramona. It's really simple. It's pretty done. Like, would you be interested? Beverly Cleary turns 100 in a few months. And we said, yeah, that makes sense. That seems pretty easy. Slam dunk. And then, you know, similar story. Like, we sold out of the first one immediately. We've done, and then we did a new edition last year, I believe it was. Maybe the year before.
Last year.
I lose track.
Me too.
The years go fast.
Yeah.
And so this is kind of the thing where it's like, you know, when you like have your ears and eyes open and people come up to you and they see what you're about, they pitch relevant projects to you. The classic example of Unfuck Your Brains, similar. She cold pitched us on our website, said that she was coming to Portland. We agreed to meet with her. You know, it was clear. She had the credentials and she had a unique set of opinions and voice, and so it worked well. And this is going to outsell Make Your Place with time, so probably within the next year. So, and then she's done many more books with us as part of it, so it's kind of about like answering the phone, keeping your receptors open, and like being open and knowing when to say yes and no, you know, and when to like redirect a person that is a little, that is close but a little bit off. But, so, how do we take submissions? Anyone want to field that?
On the website.
Mm-hmm. So we ask people to submit, to fill out a little form, and send us a 5-second explanation of what the strong value proposition is, what are the clear practical and emotional payoffs for the reader, how is their book different and distinguished from existing works already in print, why they want to write the book. That's a new one, which has helped, because then you can like weed out people that are all about, you know, where we'll get back to ego in a little bit. But if they're in it for money or for ego, they're more or less not going to get either of those things out of it, you know. However, if they approach it in the ways like Dr. Faith or Raleigh Briggs, then they're more likely, oddly, to get those things out of it. But so we added that as a screener question, and then we also asked them to add 3 similar books that we've already published to their own, because that also, it helped, like, we want them to have some familiarity with at least, like, what we're about, if not our existing books, and, you know, that actually does seem to do what it's supposed to do. So, why do we do these things? Rather than...
They're serious.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And rather than, like, most places, they just have them shovel manuscripts at them. You know, why do we do it this way instead?
Because slush piles are just a stereotype. Why not have it just not exist at all?
But who's going to fund the recycling industry?
Also, they define themselves for you. You can see the definition a lot better than if they don't say those things.
Yeah.
So it helps them define themselves to themselves.
And reading unedited books is not terribly fun either.
Yeah, it's a time waster.
Mm-hmm.
You know, funnel it a little bit for a better...
Tighter
percentage of, you know, odds that it might be a good fit.
Yeah, it is. Takes less time and it's higher rate of success. So you want the author to learn to think about their own work in the way that they must if they're going to succeed. Like, they have to think about the other books on the shelf or they're not going to write with them in mind. And you want them to research and you want them to know what is in print and you want them to understand how their book is different, because that will inform how they write their book, you know, and that really, really helps the book to be worth reading, because nothing is worse than somebody writing a book like no book on the subject has ever existed before, because they just have to rip back to the drawing board. But that is how most authors approach it, you know, oddly enough. You know, you really want them to demonstrate that they can work with you, be a team player, follow directions, read instructions, and, you know, so publishing is all costs and consequences. So it's like, when we publish a book, that costs us an average of about $20,000 before we start even to think about author royalties, and so we have to be, and also notable, our average profit margin is 3.01%. So that's a lot of cost to not a lot of reward. So we have to be very careful about what we do. So we can only publish so many books every year, or we just stall out and can't do the proper amount of work for each one. So if an author is not willing to do the work, or their ego or anxiety makes them too difficult to work with, the costs on morale and burnout on the staff is just not worth any amount of sales, you know. You have to preserve the all of the resources, you know. So think of it as like an x-axis that is ego and a y-axis that is anxiety. And if they have too little of either one or both, they're going to fail. If they have too much of either one or both, they're going to fail. So you want them kind of healthfully in the middle, where they're like, they care to succeed, but they're not crippled by their anxiety. And they want to be in the public sphere, so they have enough of an ego, but not too much ego to, like, you want them to understand that what they do does matter, and so there are ramifications of their actions, because nothing is worse than, like, an author that is so pompous that they don't understand when they're not being helpful, or just has no investment in the outcome, you know, like, both of them are sort of have the same result. So once it's established that somebody is a good fit, we research their credentials, we look into their credibility, we look into their platform, we look at their existing work, you know, even if that's just like their blog or, you know, wherever they're writing about the thing. And we ask them to submit whatever sample they have. If they insist that their book is finished, we explain that, you know, we will perform a thorough developmental and structural edit. In the 24-year history of Microcosm, we have received exactly one book that was delivered finished, and it was The Prodigal Rogerson. And I think it was just because the author had shopped it to so many places for years before we published it. And I think we found maybe two typos. Something
like
is used to being places where there isn't a good amount of editing publishing his work. So he knows that if you put in the time, you'll get a lot out of that. And, you know, he's not in it for the ego or the money, you know. He has a job where he makes his money. And so in the much more likely event that the book is unfinished and more of an idea than a book, we ask the author to create an outline. So intro, chapters, conclusion, and then to write a paragraph describing each chapter. So it would look at stating the main knowledge and skills the reader will take from that chapter, you know, to why it's included in the book, basically. And give us a little color about what sort of research, science, details, and examples the book touches on to sort of see where they're coming from. And then gradually this frame becomes the hierarchy of information to show how the book progressively builds on itself. So, you know, how it's a book. Because it's like a book is not just like a certain number of words or like a certain number of essays or pages. It's like, to be a book, it has to, you know, go somewhere from beginning to end. Like, you wouldn't, if you read it out of order, it would make less sense. You know, these frame paragraphs typically become the intro to each chapter, you know, if they're done well. And for just about any author, that's the perfect way to begin the writing process, because then you're looking at why you're including things, what you're including, where it's taking you. So when we accept a book that doesn't meet these criteria, or as often happens, the author submits a manuscript that doesn't match what we agreed upon, and we publish it anyway, the result is we have a lot of boxes that hold down the floor because they can't connect with readers. People don't understand it. It doesn't fit our core competencies. We've stretched too far beyond what we're good at, and it harms our ability to keep publishing. So, you know, slowly we can try and expand that those things and build relationships to grow sustainably without as much risk. But when we try to do this too fast, you know, like we published this book, Amika's World, and we kind of got met, you know, and it's a really cool book. It's not that it's a bad book. It's just that we are the wrong publisher for a nature book like this. So our fans and our account buyers weren't, you know, going bananas for it. I wish I could make a Rhea pun, but...
Can you open it so that people know, like, what its style is?
Yeah, oh yeah, that's a good idea. So it's all about the first Gene Goodall fellow and his pet giant bird that is now bigger than he is.
It's a mini coffee table book.
Yeah. And this thing is 7 feet tall now. So
we should have done the book 7 feet tall.
The book, when they the book account people could look at the giant life-size cutout of the bird, they like understood it that way, but I guess everybody can't have a giant cutout of the bird in their store.
I'm gonna give up on that book.
No, it's not dead yet. Mm-hmm. But that's the kind of thing. It was a little too fast, too soon. Never give up.
And when you say we can build relationships, or like, do you mean put another book out that's in the pet realm so that then you have two things to offer them?
Yeah. Anyway.
Like do not pet?
Something like that, or something that, yeah, fits, you know, like that. Like a book that is sort of between those two. So, like, that book works because we can sell it as a comic book. We can sell it as a book for that is like in the mental health category, because it's about service animals. We can sell it in the adjacent worlds. It's not relying solely on nature. Mm-hmm. But, so those things, you know, that's a good example, because it helps. And so, you know, there was a time when books like Unfuck Your Brain were just snoozers and horribly unpopular and nobody cared. And then, so, you know, the world changes also is part of it. Trump and yeah, that was probably the largest factor. People were ready to unfuck their brains, and they were ready to recognize that their brains were fucked after the election. If the book is a clear slam dunk, we proceed. If we need an expert's perspective, we discuss it in an email chain with our editors, our marketing people, our salespeople, basically like whoever would approach the kind of accounts that would be handling the book, you know? Publicity, you know, whomever has those relationships. What are the kind of people that are interested in this subject, interested in reading about, you know? And sometimes you have to go outside of your group and go to friends or people that you know read those kinds of books and say, what do you want? Like, what is the thing that is not completely saturated? Because, you know, nothing strikes more insincere than, like, throwing another book at a group that does not want another book or does not need another book.
Give an example about why would a literary
mm-hmm.
bookstore,
yeah.
they sell a guy. And my approach to, and the way I see it is melding the different characteristics of what the market is.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, a book on where Lord Byron slept, you know.
Yeah, oh yeah, that's a good crossover.
You know, wrote, you know,
yeah, yeah.
picture, or where this happened, or
mm-hmm.
whatever, that has to do with literary whatever.
Right, because it hits both audiences.
A marriage.
Yeah, a crossover.
A crossover that would work. You know, Autumn.
Yeah.
Can I say, you know, who does the Nick Cave
book? Uh-huh.
And the Morrissey book, and hopefully that Ramones book is coming out.
And Metallica. Mm-hmm.
Those are great books, but I could see a marriage of her. Because mm-hmm. recently she's been talking, you know, I've seen these cards she's done.
Yeah.
Of rock stars.
Yep, astrology.
Amazing.
Yeah, we're going to do that one too.
We're doing it?
You are
yeah,
going to
yeah.
do that.
Mm-hmm.
See, that would be a perfect marriage, you know,
yeah.
Of her beautiful graphic style.
Mm-hmm.
And if she made a major arcana card deck.
Right.
Interesting interpretations,
the yeah.
whatever, that uh-huh. are, you know, like legitimate kind of thing.
Yeah.
I mean, we could sell, I can say, we can sell tons of that. We can sell it to record stores.
Yeah.
We can sell it to occult metaphysical stores, you know, just all kinds of general bookstores, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, total.
So I'm really curious about the trend you said the market has found, that, like, the series of books is really strong right now. Like, that's, I think, why we saw so much success with Dr. Faith putting out so many books. Like, they all kind of carry each other.
Mm-hmm.
So do you think that's something that nonfiction authors should try and think about and be strategic about?
And fiction authors.
Mm. Yeah, that's true. It's always been fiction. Like, you're going to sell more books if there's more books that people have to
mm-hmm.
buy because they bought the one book.
And even, like, the introducing series, those
yeah.
graphic guides, those, I mean, it's the same idea. It's like they're all different authors. They have hundreds of books in the series, you know, and it's just kind of a slam dunk where you're not, it's not a debut book from a debut author. It's like, oh, it's the newest book in the series.
Yeah, totally.
Yes, in the Neon Hat.
I have a question. What are our best practices, or what are the best practices that we could do for diversifying our author pool?
So it's the same as anything else. It's like you have a funnel, and it's everything that goes into the funnel determines what comes out of the funnel. So if you're only promoting yourself in the UK, you're only going to get UK authors. If you're only marketing yourself, you know, in a specific subject, that's all you're going to get. And like diversity is exactly the same way. It's like if you're pushing yourself to those audiences, that is who you'll get. You know, that's who will submit. That is, you know, and you don't want it. You never want it to be just somebody's diversity is their reason for publication. You want somebody's diversity is the stepping stone that makes their perspective different for writing the book. That is, makes them as valid as anybody else writing a book, you know. So when you look at it that way and you go to events, you promote yourself in communities. The curious thing about Twitter that seems to have really struck me is that when you promote yourself sort of blindly that way and say, like, we want diverse authors, the people that come are not the diverse authors. The people that come are the people that are like, oh, I want to get published. You know, I see an opportunity for me. And that has been very fascinating. But again, when you promote through channels that have diverse people, potential authors, prospective authors following, that's how you know, it's like anything else in the world. What, you know, the people that see it determines who submits, determines, you know, and then they also have to have a sense that you are the right fit, you have a core competency with this subject, etc., you know. So that's sort of the other trouble, is like we get a lot of people that want to write fantasy novels or poetry, Christian books or whatever, and it's just not a good fit, you know, because they've like never looked at our catalog of what we do. And then the most fascinating thing for us is almost all of our authors were once people that bought our books. So that has also been, and same thing with Henry and Glenn. The author was familiar with who we were through other means from books we had done years prior, and came to us when they wanted to make this very mainstream book.
Should talk about coloring books. I always find coloring books to be really interesting, like discussion of acquisitions and how you decide if something's worth.
So there's two.
Cause there's lots of great ideas for coloring books.
Right. So you have sort of three modalities with coloring books. You have, so the era of stress relief coloring books is more than dead. Like, it's been so thoroughly saturated that there are so many books of coloring mandalas, if that's what you want to do with your life, that another one never needs to be published in the history of the world, or in the future of the history of the world. And so what you want to do is, adult coloring books are okay, but you need to have a different, you know, a similar, like, thematic leg other than it being a coloring book. So you want it to, the subject matter needs to fit in somewhere. And it needs to be colorable is the other important leg. People forget that part, oddly enough. And I can't tell you how many times we've had to redirect the artist to make the pages able to be colored.
Yeah.
Because they don't, and oftentimes they don't want them to be colored because they believe it will ruin them. Mm-hmm. Oddly enough.
The badge one is coming out pretty quick.
Oh yeah, my badge is at the printer now, so that will be awesome. A new, yeah, that's a good example. It's like, has a clear audience, it has a clear perspective, it has a clear subject, and it has a clear set of retailers that would sell it, and plenty that will know to avoid it.
You know, there's never a lack of interest in a woman's vaginal area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so that's
especially if it looks like a trendy mermaid.
And that is, yeah, it's like the author believes, I think, that it is like a sex ed book, which no retailer will probably see it that way. And there are plenty of stores that will keep a very wide berth from it, but those aren't the ones we're concerned about. We're worried about the ones that want it.
And, like, if I may interject too, like, every potential customer I've talked to about that book thinks it's awesome, mm-hmm. hilarious, and they do believe that in some ways it is education because it's like destigmatizing something that's so stigmatized.
Yeah.
So, and like we talked about at the beginning, like as an author, what you're bringing, if you believe it's doing something for a reader,
yeah,
that's what matters about your idea.
Right. Yes. And this is, it's also going to be our first ever book of poetry, so that would be...
I don't think we ever, ever, ever would have done a book of poetry, so... Well,
this makes it saleable.
Yeah.
Because it's not...
Yeah.
It's not just a book of poetry.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a ridiculous book of rhymes that are silly, but have a point.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it's like you can't, well... Plenty of people take themselves too seriously, but the book works because the author doesn't.
Yeah. Who should write a nonfiction book? Like, who do you have to be? What experiences do you have to have? How much experience? Should you have a degree? Should you have, you know, like...
This is an excellent question. A person should write a book when they find no book that exists that services their interests. Like, if they have...
No book exists that services their interests.
Like, they have interest in a subject matter... And they've read all the books, and they've found them all lacking in one way.
Mm.
And I feel like, because then they'll have the passion to put in the time, they'll have the perspective to know what it needs to say, they'll have the, you know, their motivations are pure, you know, and they will probably be very successful because there will be other people like them that want that book. And that is... That has forever been a good guide. Because when you... So the biggest mistake people make is they try to write a book for everyone. And that is impossible. And there is no everyone. You have to think of who your person... Like, who it is for, specifically.
Mm-hmm.
And when you approach writing a book that way, it solves all of those problems. It connects all your dots. Because it's a book for you. And people like you.
Mm-hmm.
And there's always people like you.
Yeah, I don't...
Feminist weed farmer.
Yeah, that's a good example. Right, there it was... There were, like, adjacent books like that, but nothing quite like it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it is...
Not by a woman of color.
There are other books by a woman of color, but that wasn't... It wasn't, like, central to their framing.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And there's, you know, there's a lot of books that have the same information, but maybe have, like, different presumptions and biases mm-hmm. about the reader. And I feel like that is, like, she's not trying to take that out of it. She's putting that front and center. You know, and similarly, like, there's a lot of gardening books, but, like, this book is the only book that teaches you how to grow your garden inside your apartment.
What's the title?
Home Sweet Home Grown. It helps to have read all the books, but you don't. That's the best education.
Yeah.
Because then you know how they're structured, you know what the arguments are, you know what to say and what nobody cares about.
Yeah. Can you talk about If You're Freaking Out, Read This? I'm... really mm-hmm. curious about the origin story of that book, because I think it's such a cool idea, but also there might be other things like it. How did you know it was
how was it special
enough, I guess? Yeah,
so If You're Freaking Out, Read This had the funniest origin story because the author's friend submitted it to us when it was just, I think, 10 pages.
Why? Was their friend our friend? Or their
nope.
friend was just bold?
The author just has a lot of anxiety.
Mm.
I mean, the author is...
Would you believe it?
Freaking out, you might say. And so, yeah, I think it was that simple. You know, and it was... We did a lot of development on it. You know, and so the amalgamation of workbook and self-help book, I think, was sort of in the perfect... stride, and then our ability to have published similar books was good. And so the real, you know, I mean, the honest truth is every other book like this book is targeting therapists, professionals. Yeah, it's like not for a young person that's struggling. And I think the reason this was successful, and the thing that's definitely different about it, is it's aimed at a younger person, but it doesn't feel inauthentic. You know, whereas a lot of the stuff that's written to YA is completely insulting because it's written by a 40-year-old therapist that wants to tell kids how to not freak out, who has never once freaked out, you know? So I think we had the perfect balance of, like, we had the freak out person and the 40 some Ural therapists paired together to, you know, round out, like, okay, is this actually dangerous advice? Is this good advice? Like, does this help young people? Does this feel authentic, you know? And she has, like, a pretty solid social media, too, but I do think that was less here. I think it was mostly that it feels like a, you know, as much as there are so many books like that, you know, they're often a professional selling a service where they're like, get your DBT here, you know, whereas this book is like advice from someone that's been there, which is weirdly, I don't know, I feel like that is weirdly off limits to most publishers.
Yeah. What's the hardest lesson to learn about acquisitions?
Not to buy to your own taste. Like, to buy, to select it based on how well it fits the catalog, not, like, falling in love with it. Because it's like, you can fall in love with a lot of bad dates in the world.
True that.
And they will not, you might be in love with them, but they will not love you. And it is, so yeah, you think about it that way, and you're like, okay, what is, the lesson is to, like, put in the time to test it, to make sure it holds up.
Yeah.
To make sure there's an audience that we can get that to that audience, and that the person will work with us, you know. And it's, you know, so it's, the thing is, like, Amika is not over yet, but we didn't sell, you know, I think we're still 2/3 in the hole on Amika. So it's, you know, it was not because the author wasn't working, it
all
was
things take their time.
It was just because it was not the right book for us to publish at that time.
Yeah.
You know.
It's a sleeper, but I still can see we're going to sell it out. We're going to sell it out, god damn it.
Okay. It's the spirit.
Before I retire, we're going to sell it out.
What is the most recent thing you've learned about acquisitions?
Mm.
The spirit of education.
Oh,
something,
yes.
Something you're still learning, or just recently learned, or need to learn.
The things that I take for granted, I have to spell out for other people. Because I, you know, it's like, I feel like I've said something so many times, but I maybe haven't said it in a way that resonates or is heard, or, you know. So even if it's just, like, whether that's, like, to an author or to our own staff or to the public or whatever, you know, it's like, to me, there is, like, such a clear set of parameters for what makes something successful. But if somebody doesn't understand that, or we don't have, like, good documentation, or, you know, then they might not understand why something succeeded or failed, you know?
Yeah.
Or, like, we haven't communicated enough about it internally, because it's oftentimes people see what they want to see, or, you know, me and myself too. Thank you.
Visit us at microcosmpublishing.com.
Thanks so much for joining us once again on People's Guide to Publishing, the podcast. I am your host, Joe Beal, the autistic publisher.
I'm Ellie Blue, the editor who doesn't pay attention to commas.
And please send us your questions so we can answer them on future episodes. And please, please do give us those reviews on iTunes and everywhere else that podcasts are reviewed. 5 stars, if you please. And have a wonderful week.
Thank you. You can find us on the internet at microcosmpublishing.com or microcosm.pub if you want to keep it short and simple. You can also find us on Twitter at microcosm, on Facebook at microcosm publishing, on Instagram at microcosm_pub, and here in Portland on North Williams Avenue.
Thank you so much.